Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you for being here. We do have public hearings and possible work sessions for different bills. What we're going to do, though, is first open up a work session. We have three bills that we had previously heard that we want to go ahead and get those on their way. So we'll open up a work session first, starting with on the top, 492.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 492 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves Senate Bill 492 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes.
Senator Thatcher.
Until I hear from the lips of the individuals who had some issues with it last time it melted down on the floor, I will be withholding my yes vote. And, yeah, all right, just so you know.
All right, I'll put something on the record, too. Any other questions? So 492, for those who have not been around the last session, is a bill that is a resurrection of one that actually history says it passed 59-0 on the House side. It came over here, it passed 5-0 out of the committee. It got to the floor, and then a couple of our members start thinking back as their marital past as to the differences in thinking that they're somehow going to have resurrection of either prior existing spousal support orders or ones that might create the opportunity to start a spousal report support obligation. The bill clearly then and clearly now says no, that's not the case, but we'll have a little bit more discussion. I've had discussions with one of those two individuals. Hopefully they understand it better than they did last time. The other one is no longer with us, not because of concerns with the bill, just his ticker stopped ticking. So with that, is there any other discussion or comments? Is there any objection besides Senator Thatcher to the passage of Senate Bill 492 to the floor with the due pass recommendation?
I'll express concern with that. The avoidance of the court system, you know, just putting it in the mail and sending it off sounds a little iffy to me, so I'll also object.
Okay, fair enough. We'll have a great discussion. Thank you very much. Motion does pass. Chair will carry 492. I'd like to put Senator Gelser on that, but we've decided that she did her battle last time. And so with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 492. We'll now open up a work session on Senate Bill 522.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 522.
Senator Thatcher moves to adopt the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 522. Discussion? Senator Thatcher?
Explain.
Okay.
Just want a good explanation on the record.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Thatcher, as you might recall, this is the requirement to maintain life insurance. The -1 amendments replace the term all persons with all named third-party beneficiaries. This was worked out among the stakeholders as providing effective constructive notice to all third-party beneficiaries of the judgment provisions regarding life insurance rather than all parties, and this relieved the concerns of the insurance industry that they had with receiving notice just by entry of a judgment.
And as I'm looking across the panel of our individuals here today, I don't see anyone jumping up and yelling and raising their hand saying, oh, no, that's not it. So we'll take that as gospel. And with that, is there any objections to the motion to adopt the -1s in the Senate Bill 522? So ordered.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 522 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves Senate Bill 522 to the floor as amended by the -1s with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Does anyone want to volunteer to carry Senate Bill 522?
Okay.
Senator Thatcher will volunteer, so thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 522. And we'll open up our last work session that's set aside for Senate Bill 338.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 338.
Senator Thatcher now moves the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 338. Any discussion on the motion? Senator Manning.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, can I get another refresher on this one here?
Yes, you.
Chair Prasansky, Senator Manning, Senate Bill 338, this is your guaranteed asset protection waiver. This is when you buy a new car and you drive it off the lot and the loan value is greater than the value of the car. This covers that in-between period. The dash ones give the exemption to finance agreements sold or assigned to the consumer finance company, not the ones generated by the consumer finance company.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any clarity on that now?
Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Any other questions or discussion? Any objection to the motion to adopt the dash ones in Senate Bill 338? Not seeing any, so ordered. Senator Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 338 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves the Senate Bill 338 to the floor as amended by the dash ones with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Manning, now that you are very aware of the dash ones, I hope that you'll be our carrier.
I will be the carrier.
Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 338. And now we're going to go ahead and go to our public hearings. We're going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 57. Chana?
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, in 2014, Oregon established the statewide office of the public guardian and conservator within the office of the long-term care ombudsman. That was Senate Bill 1553 that established that, if you're interested. This provides guardianship and conservatorship services to individuals who do not have appropriate friends or family to serve in that role and who lack the resources to hire a professional guardian. Senate Bill 57 modifies the operational statutes of the office of the public guardian and conservator. And we're here to tell you more about that today.
All right, thank you. So we have Travis and Fred. Fred, I had a question for you. There's two other bills that we're taking testimony on. Your name was on there. It looks like lightly scratched. I just want to make certain you're off the...
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. So who would like to start, if you'll give us your name, and we'll take it from there.
Sure, okay. Yes, I'm Travis Wall, and I'm the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator. And just for reference, as Chandra shared, my position was established by the legislature in 2014, and our program, the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservatorship Program, has been building the foundation for public guardianship and conservatorship services since early 2015. And I might also share that ORS 125-683, part of the statute that again authorizes us, provides for me to make recommendations to the Legislative Assembly for policy and legislation regarding expanding, implementing, and improving public guardianship services. So Senate Bill 57 is essentially a cleanup bill for Senate Bill 1553, the legislation in 2014. It was passed and signed into law that provides for our office. And it cleans up a number of sort of technical issues and resolves some matters that we need to take care of going forward in terms of our operations. I'm going to actually turn to Fred first to allow him to talk about some of the elements of the bill in the front end of it, because they relate to probably a larger concern.
Yeah, so Chair Prasansky, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, I'm Fred Steele. I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman and Director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And when the Public Guardian Program for Oregon was first established in 2014 through Senate Bill 1553, the Public Guardian Program was placed in our office, an appropriate placement. Since then, as of July last year, some new federal rules came into effect that clarify and create create a conflict between public guardianship and a public guardian program inside a long-term care ombudsman program. So this bill, I just really wanted to be here to answer any questions, if there were any questions, as Section 1 in particular in the bill addresses some of that relationship between the public guardian program and the long-term care ombudsman program. We're not changing where it's housed, but as you'll see some of the deletions in there in particular about the supervision and control, it's kind of a first step towards addressing that conflict with federal rule. There's another bill up this session that would address larger concerns, and as I've been told by the feds, they're not concerned if we don't fix it this session, but they do want us to see us trying to address it. So just really wanted to be here to answer any questions if there were any.
All right. And well, did you have other?
Yeah, let me just sort of highlight the other key elements that the bill addresses. So again, these are just in many respects kind of technical issues. So the bill clarifies who a court may appoint as a fiduciary in protective proceedings involving my program and my staff. It clarifies that I would be appointed and not my staff, and my staff would be responsible to me. It clarifies the authority of the public guardian and conservator to obtain information from public agencies when we're assessing the need of an individual for guardianship. Statute presently is potentially problematic around us getting the information that we need to have to support the petitions that we file on behalf of individuals. It also provides for the court for a court to establish the amount of the required bond that that my staff and I need to carry. This sort of actually goes to part of the cleanup that Fred was talking about, and we anticipate there actually may be an amendment in this area. It also provides the authority necessary for us to run criminal background checks on both my staff and myself, although SB 1553 required that we do that. It didn't provide the authority necessary for us to do that, and so when we began services, that was a challenge that we faced. It also establishes funds or accounts and the authority for us to bank with private banking institutions on behalf of protected persons. This is something that's actually an issue that's actually been a source of a continuing conversation with Treasury, and we're still in discussions with them about this issue, and we anticipate resolving those issues before we move forward with this portion of the bill. So again, we may well provide some amendments in this area, and we hope that we will have all of those amendments to you within the next week to 10 days.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for the panel? We are going to have another speaker. Judge Welch is going to be joining us. She'll be speaking on all of the different bills, but we'll just stick to 57. She's not going to speak. Okay. Any other questions or any questions for either Fred or Travis? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. So we're going to go ahead, and I'll just ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 57 that did not sign up. Not, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 57. And we have a number of individuals that have signed up to testify on the next three bills. Because of the complexity or issues, and I'm going to go ahead and do them separately. So I apologize to those who are speaking on multiple bills, but we're going to have you come back and forth between the bills just to keep things orderly. Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I wonder if I could make some opening remarks before we get into these bills.
Yeah. Did you want to make them on all of them?
I think I can, just to help frame them.
All right. So why don't we, and did you want to do like one set of comments for all three?
Yes.
Why don't you go ahead and do that, and then we'll go ahead and open them up separately.
Great. And if you don't mind, I'll just do it from here.
That'd be great.
Okay. Thanks. Colleagues, the three bills that we're going to be talking about today are all bills that I have a lot of history with, and it goes back to my very first session in the legislature, 2009. I was on the Human Services Committee, and I was the newbie on that committee, and so I was assigned to the work group that was considered the most no-hoper of all the work groups. And that had to do with the problem of how to deal with indigent Oregonians who needed protective services. And we were, at the time, a state that had no public guardianship office for the state. Multnomah County did, and a couple of other counties had, you know, some sort of minimal services that they were able to provide. But for the state as a whole, we did not. We had this work group was chaired by the estimable Judge Betsy Welch from Multnomah County, a real expert in the area of family law, probate law, and it was it brought together a great group of people from all relevant stakeholders to try to put together a program that would, on the one hand, provide protection for the individuals, but also And this was something I really had no idea about, but I came to really understand and appreciate that when you put someone under protection into a guardianship situation, that is an enormous compromise of their civil rights. You know, they lose the ability to make decisions for themselves. And so, you know, it's not a decision that should be made lightly. One of the things that, you know, that I discovered was not only that we didn't have a state guardianship, public guardianship program, but we also didn't have an automatic process for a hearing when guardianship was being considered. If there was a hearing, the individual who is going to be subject to losing their rights didn't have automatic right to counsel to help them help with that decision being made. And so the recommendation that came out of that first version of the task force was to create a public guardianship program and to work on this problem of a lack of a hearing and a right to counsel. This, you may remember, you know, as I mentioned, this was 2009, the height of the recession, and there was just no way that we could get the funding to do any of those. But we kept the work group going. We were joined by Chana Newell, actually, became support for it, and did a great job. Eventually, we were able to pass 1553 back in 2014 that did create the Public Guardian Office, which is great. But we still face those two lacks related to a right to counsel and a right to a hearing. And that's why these bills are coming before you. The other thing that we came to really understand and appreciate, and I'll say deplore, was some practices that we were seeing around court visitors in some of our areas. You know, the degree to which once someone is put into guardianship, it's really important that the court maintain eyes and ears over that guardianship relationship. And that's the job of the court visitor. But we were seeing some abuses out there that really needed to be rectified. And so before you today is Senate Bill 503, which is looking at this problem of court visitors and trying to come up with uniform standards and policies that would assure us that these court visitors were really acting in the best interests of the people that they were overseeing. So that's just a kind of background to all of these, and I think you'll hear from some really very good people who can talk about the, you know, the details of how these bills would really move us in the right direction as a state to find that balancing act between giving people the protection that they need, but also making sure their civil rights are not inappropriately compromised and that decisions are being made that really are in their best interest. So thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. So we're going to go ahead and open up our first of the public hearings on Senate Bill 501. Chan, if you can give us an overview, please.
Certainly, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 501, as Senator Dembro mentioned, deals with guardianship and the appointment of counsel for a protected person. A 501 would require appointment of counsel for a proposed protected person when the person requests counsel, an objection has been made by any person, the court deems counsel as appropriate, or the court visitor recommends the appointment of counsel. This would be paid for out of the estate of the protected person if there are sufficient funds, and if there are not, it would be paid for by the Office of Public Defense Services. This does have a referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right. So I have a couple of different, we have about seven people who are scheduled to testify on this, so I'm going to call the first panel, Gail Christensen, Joseph Leham, and then Travis Wall, if you'll come back up, please. Good morning. So whoever would like to start, if you'll give us your name first and then your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chairperson, members, my name is Gail Christensen. I'm a court visitor in Multnomah County. I agree that there should be an appointed attorney for all persons who are the subject of a protective proceeding. I think that the bill is lacking in some areas. My main concern is how you would pay for it. And I think that might cause that provision to fail, and that's unfortunate. I know in other areas, lawyers are required to take a reduced fee or can only charge so much. That might help. It's also very difficult to do pro bono work in the environment with the PLF. It's cost prohibitive. If somebody doesn't practice on a regular basis but does want to donate their work, I believe it's like $3,500 to do that to the professional liability fund. So I just think the culture of the bar needs to change a little bit. I also think that in addition to having an attorney, there should be a provision that says that attorney can't withdraw without permission of the court. A large part of the problem is not the fact that a person is, say, unrepresented in the initial hearing, but the fact that there is no set of eyes going forward. Nobody looks at the Guardian reports, except for perhaps, you know, an analyst at the court who's looking at dozens and dozens of them. And nobody is personally responsible for that issue. It's something, and I've looked at any number of Guardian reports that are simply lacking any and all information, but nobody's looking at that. The court visitors dropped off at the end of the case. I don't see it. I'm not a party to the case, so I don't get served with any pleadings. And especially in cases where people are indeed incapacitated and can't keep up with this stuff, very often it's the guardian who's being served and the protected person who's being served, and nobody else. And the protected person doesn't have eyes to protect themselves. So I think there should be an additional provision that says, you know, you only withdraw with court petition, with court permission, and in that case, you know, if the court saw that this is the case, that there's nobody looking out, that another attorney could be appointed. So I think this is a good provision. I think this is a good bill. I think it is lacking, and I think that could cause its failure at this point.
All right. So I have you marked as a yes, meaning you're for the bill, but you'd like to see some changes?
Or additions? Yeah, some big changes. Okay.
All right. I appreciate that, Gail. I just want to make sure we have that on the record since it says for it. So who'd like to go next? And we're going to come back for questions, and I'll address some of the stuff that you raised at that time.
No, I would be glad to go next, Chairman. Again, my name is Travis Wall. I'm the Oregon Public Guardian. And again, thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee for allowing me to speak before you today about this important issue. As Senator Denbrough has shared, the concerns around due process with guardianship as well as other procedural and protections have been a concern for decades. In the late 1980s, the Associated Press published a five-part series that was carried around the country about thousands of guardianship cases that they had reviewed in different jurisdictions. And they documented extensive problems around the practice of guardianship, private and public, at that time. That prompted Congress, the House Subcommittee on Aging at the time, held hearings and published two reports on guardianship. That in turn prompted a wave of reform that continues into this day. And unfortunately, we continue to see many challenges and problems in the guardianship world. Those problems, I think, are amplified here in Oregon by the absence of some basic procedural protections that now most states have. So today, if you look at the statutory landscape across the country, you'll find that 49 states mandate hearings in all continuing guardianship petitions. In most states, appointment of counsel is for respondents is either mandatory or assured. In all but several of states, some level of medical or other evidence of incapacity is required and must be provided at guardianship hearings. These are all areas in which Oregon law comes up short. This is something that is not new to many of us, some of whom have been here far longer and practicing for a much greater period of time than me here in Oregon. There have been efforts in the 90s as well as in the 2000s to address this issue. In 2008, there was a task force report to the Oregon Judicial Department prepared at the direction of then Chief Justice DeMuniz. I'll allow Judge Welch to speak more to this report because she was one of the two chairs of it. But among the issues that addressed was the lack of counsel and the critical element counsel must play in all of this. We will, of course, talk when we take up 503 in a few minutes about the issues around the need for court visitors that are trained and qualified and have sufficient experience to carry out their responsibilities. But all of these elements are critical. And as Senator Dembrough shared with you, the imposition of guardianship is a drastic and severe step. And it deprives people who are subject to it substantial, in many cases, most of their rights and often for the rest of their life. Now, many of us have different experiences around what happens when guardianship is imposed. And I know there are people here that in most cases in which they've seen guardianships carried out, the person has needed and it's been not disputed. I will tell you that that's not my experience. And I've been involved with guardianships in four different states, including Oregon. I was the public guardian in Utah, and I worked on these issues in a capacity that was very closely related to guardianship monitoring in Nevada and California. And I can tell you that I would say that probably 5 to 10, perhaps as high as 15% of the people who face the prospect of guardianship are people where there may be some dispute about their capacity. And there may be larger numbers of people than that who don't want to have a guardianship imposed. So due process becomes a very important element in this area. I think, you know, we are well aware of the financial challenges that the legislature faces this year and the hurdle that that's going to be around trying to address all of the bills that we're talking about in relation to guardianship today, including this one, which probably may be the most costly of the three. I mean no disrespect to anybody here, but I would suggest to you that that we have a Bill of Rights in this country, and it doesn't have a price tag, and we need to begin to honor it as we should for the people that face the prospect of guardianship. Thank you.
Thank you. And Joseph?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I'm a professional clinical social worker, and I've worked in across the state of Oregon for approximately 12 years, and I come before you also as a trained and certified mental health examiner.
Joseph, I need you to put your full name on the record, please.
Oh, I apologize. That's okay. Joseph Lycum.
Thank you.
Yeah. I come today as a certified mental health examiner in the civil commitment process. Part of the reason that I bring testimony today is that having seen both firsthand the guardianship process as well as the civil commitment process, I cannot tell you how stark the difference in those legal proceedings is. The information that Mr. Wall testified on in regards to the necessity of due process, the civil commitment proceeding is a place where there is a great deal of due process, not only in the structure of statute, specifically statutes such as ORS 426, which oversees the structure of the civil commitment court proceedings and the appointment of various court officers, but also a whole wealth of OARs and superstructures that are to arrange and protect the civil liberties of individuals under civil commitment. Both individuals who are before the court for civil commitment and guardianship have profound impairment, either through mental health or disability, and they are both a very vulnerable group of Oregon citizens. They obviously need protection, but in the civil commitment proceedings, the role of the mental health examiner, which I have played, is a process where I have been treated with a great deal of respect by the courts. My testimony is valued. I am offered the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses, as opposed to the office of the court visitor, where I have seen strong authoritative testimony from expert visitors absolutely disregarded in the pursuit of protection of civil liberties of a person under guardianship. Part of the difficulty of the lack of appointed counsel specific to SB 501 is that without counsel on both sides, there is also a lack of appeal of guardianship. And so there is a lack of case law that allows and guides further guardianship hearings. This is absolutely not the case in the civil commitment process, where many, many, many commitment orders are challenged under appeal, and that appeal case law comes back to justices at the community level that shapes their opinion. And finally, I would also like to comment on specifics, there are a great deal of very specific civil rights limitations under the civil commitment process, specifically time limitation. There's enumeration under ownership of firearms, and there's also structure and guidance to the individual's custodians when they are committed in terms of their movement, placement, and control of their physical bodies and treatment. These structures are not afforded or organized under any guardianship law. Therefore, when a person is placed in guardianship, it is, as several people have testified and probably will today, for life, and that guardian is given virtually unlimited power and control over that person's civil rights. I would strongly urge passing this and others forward in terms of the bills. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So before we take questions, Geld, I just want to put on the record for you. This process, as a substantive committee, the bill comes to us. We will make whatever adjustments we think we may need to make at this level. But it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Ways and Means is the committee that actually has the authority on the money part. And so some of your comments that you shared with us today, and I expect that we more than likely will move the bill to Ways and Means, that would be an appropriate place for you to raise those concerns to ensure that they understand the importance of funding to make the program work. Any questions for anyone on the panel?
Well, yeah, I guess
Senator Thatcher?
I have had constituents come in. I'm not real familiar with the guardianship programs, but I have had constituents say to me that their family member who has been placed under guardianship is being taken advantage of. And is there any, I mean, it sounds like there isn't much in place to help alleviate some of those concerns that family members might even have over a court-appointed guardian. Is that right?
If I may, I will answer. Again, this is Travis Wild, Chairman and Senator. There are some mechanisms. I think they're insufficient, and they are matters for discussion with us and you going forward. But I will point out that the court has overall authority over the appointment and oversight of guardians and conservators. And the court does have some resources, at least statutorily, at its disposal, including the use of a court visitor. A court visitor is used on the front end, as we've shared, to evaluate the petition that the petitioner has brought forward, its merits, its facts, as well as the whether or not the individual has the capacity or incapacity to make decisions and makes recommendations to the court. And subsequent to the appointment of the guardianship, statute does provide the court the ability to use the visitor to follow up on concerns. There are some other limited mechanisms that provide some degree of oversight in Oregon. There is a voluntary program that was facilitated by statute that you passed in 2014 that exists in several counties, including Multnomah. It's an organization called Guardianship Partners, and it's working with local courts, again, in 2 to 3 counties to assist the court in doing some monitoring of guardians. But outside of that, there is no real mechanism. And this is something that has, again, been commented on in relation to the abuses that have been documented in the guardianship world for the past 35 years. A number of states have sought to address this in a variety of ways. One small step we took here in Oregon was some 3 years ago, we passed a requirement that guardians be professional guardians, that is, people who serve 3 or more individuals and are essentially doing it on a fee-paying basis. Those professional fiduciaries, including my office, are required to be certified. However, there are limitations. The certification process could certainly be made much stronger, and it's not licensure, and it provides some degree of oversight, but the entity that's responsible for it is an out-of-state entity that oversees things in some 6 states, and to my knowledge, they have only investigated and disciplined 10 guardians in the roughly 10 or so years that they've been doing this. But other states, neighboring states like Washington and California and Nevada, actually have implemented licensing or other oversight bodies, sometimes in conjunction with the court, that in fact are a place where protected people, family members, other concerned citizens can bring complaints forward. I will also briefly share that in terms of who serves as guardians, in about 75% of cases, we estimate that it is a family member. In the remaining 25%, it is professional fiduciaries and in some cases, a public guardian when those services exist.
Thank you. Any other questions? thank you all for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and bring up the next panel, and we'll continue with, at this point, Kimberly McCullough, Sybil Hutt, and Judge Welch.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. As was mentioned earlier by Senator Dembro and others, guardianships are legal proceedings that strip an individual of many, many rights that are considered fundamental by our Supreme Court. It can strip someone of the ability to decide about their medical care, where they eat, who they spend time with, and even whether or not they'll get married. A full guardianship is really the erasure of the autonomous legal individual. And for something so serious, we really need to make sure that we have a heightened degree of scrutiny from courts and adequate due process. Guardianships are often imposed as a matter of course. When adults, seniors, develop a disability, they're often put into guardianship. Also, parents who have children with a disability are often told that they need to get a guardianship when that child turns 18, and then that just extends for the rest of their life. One of the things that I just really want to bring up is that at the ACLU, we believe that there's many less restrictive options that are available that should be considered. For healthcare decisions, you can get a power of attorney for healthcare. For financial matters, you can get a power of attorney for finances. There's also a model called supported decision making, which actually helps people with disabilities to be able to actually make decisions on their own, but with people that they trust around them, helping them to make those autonomous decisions. So because of all of this, we believe that we really need to continue to have ongoing and clear conversations about the role of guardianships in Oregon, and we'd love to be part of those conversations. As to the specifics of this bill, which appoints counsel just under various circumstances, we believe that it would help to create a situation where we have adequate due process for individuals, and it also could lead to situations where we consider alternatives, that counsel could actually help that individual advocate on behalf of themselves to either not have a guardianship or to enter into a power of attorney or to try to make arrangements with trusted individuals to do something more similar to supported decision making. So for those reasons, we support this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here, also in support of Senate Bill 501. And I very much appreciate the great work that Senator Dembro and many members of the various work groups have put into this discussion, and very much appreciate that work. The Law Center, as you know, is a provider of civil legal assistance to low-income people, and our mission is to help people achieve access to justice. Of course, principles of protection of liberty and protection of dignity and protection of safety, those are all very fundamental to the work that we do. And if people are not in a place where their liberty, safety, and dignity is protected, it becomes a barrier to them in accessing justice and achieving the life that is their fullest potential. And many times those dynamics can be very much related to whether or not a person is able to escape or survive poverty. And so this bill is very important to us because it stands for the principle that when a person or an individual or a court is taking the step of limiting someone's ability to make decisions for themselves related to health care, related to housing, related to many other details of everyday life, if that decision-making is taken away and it is put into the hands of someone else, it's critical that that other person be someone that we all have great trust and confidence in as having the capacity to do that in a way that is in the best interests of the protected person. Dynamics of power and control can often come up in the circumstances of a guardianship if that guardianship power is given to someone who is not
a person with the capacity to keep that best interest standard at heart. And so before the court is going to intervene, we think the appointment of counsel is a very good tool and really a critical tool to making sure that those decisions are made in an appropriate way. It's very difficult to unravel a guardianship that's entered inappropriately. This will be a tool to make sure that those guardianships, when they are entered, and I clarify that they're very important tools and they're important to be available for folks so that they can stay safe. We just want to make sure that they're not entered in a way that's inadvertent, and this will be a great tool to assure that safety. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Judge Walsh.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski and senators. The first thing I have to say is you got a second version of my outpouring today. I am very embarrassed by the first version. Please burn it.
And, unfortunately, we can't do that.
Well, scribble on it or something.
We'll put a note in the computer, disregard, look at second version, right?
Thank you.
And Judge Welch, I'll need you to go ahead and put your name on the record.
Yes, of course. Elizabeth Welch. We need to talk quickly about who these people are. These are old people, high percentage, people with chronic mental illness or delay that have never been able to take care of themselves effectively. They may have been on their own, but they were not effective about it. They are ourselves. They are our family. They are the neighbor. Anybody can become the target of this kind of problem, set of problems. If a person is agreeable to having a guardianship, they can participate in or plan in advance. Those are they're all those tools so that a family can move in and help grandma when the time comes that that needs to happen. Guardianship does not involve people who are holding up their hand and saying, give me a guardian. You might as well kind of rule that out. These are to some degree involuntary, if not to every degree involuntary. Very few people that we're talking about have any conception what the role of a lawyer is. So even if they have the money to pay for it, they won't necessarily understand they need one or what it's for. People have, as you might suspect, the notion that you need a lawyer because you're in trouble or that you've broken the law. And I have had many interactions with respondents in guardianships in chambers where I will try to talk to them about whether they want a lawyer, and they will say that. I don't need a lawyer. I haven't done anything wrong. No comprehension. And remember, the people we're talking about have comprehension issues almost entirely the case. Now, Travis Wall mentioned that something like 75% good guess of the guardians that are appointed are, and we're not talking about kids at all here, this is just adults, are family members. And that's supposed to make us all feel comfortable and cozy, and it's the problem. My last few years sitting on the bench, I was doing Plan B work, and mainly in Clackamas County. And the percentage of cases that I heard that had to do with the misconduct of a fiduciary was just growing and growing and growing. People take advantage of grandma. People steal from their siblings. People lock their relatives in a room and neglect them. We're talking about very significant problems. So let's say that the evil son who's doing all these bad things petitions because somebody convinces him he needs to have a guardianship. So he's the petitioning party. Now, who is there to take a look at all this and try to sort it out? And the answer is two people, a lawyer to make sure that the allegations are true, and the court visitor. And I won't talk too much about court visitors, but I just kind of want you to see the process for what it really is. These are the people that can kind of keep the situation under control. But because there are so many people who take advantage of their families, take advantage of their relatives, they tend to be people with chronic problems of their own, we need to have safeguards. People don't understand why they need a lawyer. They don't necessarily get a lawyer. The difference between, I'm sorry if I'm going to get shot for this, but 501 is everybody in a guardianship. It's very hard, and the last time that I was here talking to this committee, I think it was only Senator Przanski that is here twice. I talked about how hard it is as a lawyer to argue that one category of people needs attorneys, but the larger category, all the people covered by 501, don't. The more I think about it, I think it's almost the other way around, because this horrible problem with guardians and with the people who, so many of the people we're dealing with, is really an important part of the role that a lawyer plays when they represent an individual where there's a guardian that is not a professional, that is not Travis Wall or his deputies, but a person in the community that we don't know anything about. People need that. To me, that is probably the single most important function that a lawyer plays, is they can take a look and say, should it be grandma? It should be grandson, or should it be a professional? And there's some lawyers in the back that can tell you that when I was the judge in Multnomah County, if there were warring sisters, that was often the case, who's going to get their hands on the money or hands on something, the lawyers would tell them, she's going to say it's going to be a professional, so you guys have got to settle this. And, you know, it helped, because we have to have a way out with these situations. The civil commitment, I was so pleased with this gentleman who I've never met, the civil commitment guy who sat there before. There really isn't that much difference between a civil commitment and a guardianship. Civil commitments are not permanent. Guardianships, for practical purposes, are. They can end, they don't, other than, in a way that has nothing to do with legalities. Yet there are all these protections that have been the case in Oregon for decades. You automatically get a lawyer when there is a petition for a civil commitment. You just do. No questions asked. Services provided by the Office of Public Defense Services. We don't provide respondents. It makes no sense. And it's not fair. And these people are pathetic. They are people who cannot take care of themselves. That's why we're doing this, and they need someone to be on their side. Judges have a funny role in this area of law. The rest of it is basically adversarial. You know, there's a lawyer on one side and a lawyer on the other side, and the judge decides whose witnesses are more compelling. Here, often, there aren't two sides. There's one side, the moving party, and then there's this poor soul, many of whom don't want to even come to the hearing because they don't understand what's going on and they're scared. They just don't even want to be there. So we need to make things fair. And I'll stop talking about the other subjects till next round.
All right. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? All right, so I'm going to ask you all to step back. I do have at least one other person who wants to give testimony, Angela Plowhead, if you'll come forward. And is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 501 besides Angela? Angela, the reason I waited to call on you because you had a check mark for and against, and so I wasn't sure where you fit in, and so even though you signed up first, you'll be the best because you're the last.
I don't know if I'll be the best, but my name is Dr. Angela Plowhead. I am a clinical psychologist. I specialize in cognitive decision making and cognitive assessment. And I am also a court visitor. Like my cohort Gail Christensen, I do agree with the bill. I think that it's a wonderful thing that we have due process in this country and that that should go forward in these proceedings as well. My one recommendation is that consideration be given to the payment of the proceedings by the petitioner if there are not funds for the respondent before the burden is then put to the state.
That's it.
And that's it.
All right, thank you. So I'm open up for questions. I'm going to kind of also ask individuals here, and Senator Denbrough, since you have been so active on this, on the work groups and stuff, we've heard a couple of individuals seeking or thinking that we might need to do some additional work. And I wanted to frame it for Gail and for Angela that a lot of this is going, when you get into the money part, really gets into ways and means mm-hmm. where they can actually do some direction. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that we need to do more work as the bill in the substantive committee, or do you think it's ready to move forward to ways and means?
I think if there are changes to be made, Mr. Chair, it would be best done here before we send them down.
Okay.
So I'd be happy to engage in that.
All right. So what we're going to do is, unless there's any other questions for Angela, all right, with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 501. And I'll go ahead and make a statement for this one here. We're going to keep it here in the committee for a little bit, and we'll go through the testimony on the other two bills. I do know that there's going to be some questions, at least on one of the other two, and then we'll try to see, we'll figure out what's our next steps, more than likely a small work group, just to see what else we might need to do before we move forward with any amendments, and then we'll have them come back for additional work sessions. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 502. Shanna?
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 502 again deals with guardianship. This time it requires a hearing in any petition to appoint a fiduciary by the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator or a county program. It also requires appointment of counsel for proposed protected persons in such hearing. And again, it would be paid for out of the person's estate if sufficient funds exist or by the Office of Public Defense Services.
All right, at this time, I'm going to go ahead and call up Judge Welch back up and Travis Wall, if you'll come forward. And I think I'll go ahead and also ask Joseph Liam to please come up again. And again, even though you've given testimony, we will need your name stated for the record. And if you can provide us the testimony regarding this particular bill, then we'll come back and grab the other one. Travis, this looks like you've been volunteered.
Thank you. Yep. Okay. This is, again, Travis Wall, the Oregon Public Guardian. Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. So as has just been shared, this bill is really kind of a slimmed-down version of SB 501. It would impose many of the same requirements, but it would impose them only when the petitioner is the public guardian, either my program or the couple of county public guardianship programs that we presently have in Oregon, in Multnomah County and in Jackson County. The thinking behind this bill is that we need to find a way to move forward in trying to begin to build the structures, the statute, and the services that will afford people due process in this area. And there's a recognition on our part that that a public guardianship is in one way different than a guardianship that's brought by a family member or by a professional fiduciary. It's the government that's getting involved. And so here the heavy hand of the state is the petitioner. And in those circumstances, arguably, there may need to be greater protections than there would be in other circumstances. So that essentially goes to the heart of things. Let me very quickly share with you a couple of things as we endeavor to help expand your knowledge and understanding about guardianship. I will share with you that in addition to a number of the alternatives that were outlined earlier in the discussion about guardianship more generally, that Oregon law provides for both what we sometimes call a plenary or full guardianship as well as a limited guardianship. The idea behind a limited one is to try to tailor guardianship just to the areas in which somebody needs assistance in decision making and is less intrusive. The sad reality is that oftentimes limited guardianships really function as full guardianships, and we still have a lot of work to do in that area. The other thing I will briefly share with you is that the landscape around guardianship does vary from state to state. As Judge Wilt shared with you, guardianship is, for all intents and purposes, lifelong in most cases in Oregon. I will share with you, it does not have to be that way. There are states, including California, for instance, which has a form of guardianship for people with mental health issues that is time limited. It lasts a year, then it expires. If somebody wants to continue it, they have to repetition. So we need to look at our system as not something that's fixed. It is something that we can change and modify and make it more accountable and better tailored to serve the people that we all have a responsibility to.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joseph Lycum. Again, I'm testifying on Senate Bill 502 for this bill. Similar to my testimony on 501, I really would like to draw the committee's attention to the parallel between the civil commitment process and the guardianship process, and also actually a specific circumstance that I am quite aware of as I work both, again, with individuals who have developmental disabilities who are disproportionately represented in the guardianship process, as well as individuals with mental health conditions who typically access the civil commitment process, that it is an informal standard of practice across many mental health organizations, specifically state and county public mental health organizations, that when the bar of civil commitment is too high to reach, since it is a much more structured, organized process, that commitment investigators, the individuals tasked by county government to investigate and proceed and move on a civil commitment process, they often will seek family members to act in a guardianship because it is known that that process is much easier. So again, these two processes I think are incredibly interwoven. One process has a great deal of structure, organization, and as Judge Wells testified, the adversarial process of representation, which is really at its heart one of the greatest protections that any citizen can have of their civil liberties, that they will have a professional who is versed in the law to represent their interest in public court. And in that process in civil commitment, that is done quite regularly. In the process of guardianship, it is not. And because of that, there are a great number of people who are going harmed, and it is difficult to demonstrate data for this committee today because the nature of the process prohibits collecting this information since it's often a family member and there is no particular ability for any supportive professional agencies to demand a family member who has guardianship over their family to give that information over. While Mr. Wall's office, there are structures and rules regarding the comportment of a public official, there are no such rules governing a family member acting in the interests of a guardian of their family member.
All right, thank you. Judge Welch.
Elizabeth Welch. I want to talk a little bit about hearings because, and should have mentioned it in the first part, but it's applicable here too. Why is it important to have a hearing in every case? And of course, the arguments against it, there are some good arguments against it. It's expensive. It's probably the single most expensive thing in this whole discussion, all three of these bills, because it requires more court time. And court time is a very sensitive subject with my colleagues and with the court system. When we were working on the task force, the public guardian task force, I did a little informal poll of the larger courts where there were someone that was a designated probate judge about how they felt about these various subjects. And nobody is opposed to any of this, but it's a question of priorities. If we have hearings in every case, they don't necessarily last a long time, but that's a lot more hearings than there are now. And that means there has to be docket time, which means there has to be more judges, which means, and you know better than I how that the rest of that song goes. But I mean, that's the Ways and Means issue. But why do we need one? Why do we need, with a person who cannot speak because they are too ill or too damaged, They can't even tell you what they want or how they think. Why do we need to have a hearing? And the answer is because there is so little of the values of the adversarial process present here, the court has a duty it doesn't really have in other areas of the law. It's more of a reaching out and making sure that things are okay. It's not just a passive, I can say this because I was a judge, I just sit there and I hear what you have to say and what the other guy has to say and the witnesses, and I decide who's proven what they need to prove. Here, that whole process is missing. In a hearing where there's, it's a slam dunk, if you'll just pardon the directness of it, there still needs to be somebody who says, the provisions of the statute have been proven. This person is incapacitated, and my favorite, and the person who has been designated as the guardian is appropriate. Another safeguard against this really serious problem. The other thing is, I don't know if any of you are old enough, maybe the chair, to remember when lawyers got to do criminal cases because they were in the courthouse there at the wrong time. Now this is
volunteered item.
Yeah, right. Late 60s or into the 70s, that's the way a lot of front-end criminal matters got lawyers. Now, what we have going right now in the larger counties where there's a volume of these kind of cases is a drafting system used by the judges to get people in there. That's not the right way to provide services for people. And I'm not saying that the lawyers who get drafted aren't competent lawyers. Some of them are, and probably there might be some question about others. And there are communities where there aren't any specialists in this field, and so it gets complicated. There's a dignity of the process problem here. These are things people don't want to know about. They don't want to hear about it. The general public doesn't want to know what we've been talking about today because it's too unpleasant and maybe a little bit too close to home, whatever. But we need to have complete fairness, and we need to make sure that nobody's getting mistreated or there's been overreaching. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all for coming forward. We have two other people that are signed up for this one, Kimberly and Sybil, if you'll come back up. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who did not get a chance to sign up for Senate Bill 502?
Senator Przanski and members of the committee, I'm going to be very, very brief because I feel that the panel before us really covered everything extremely well, and I will just refer you back to my comments during Senate Bill 501's hearing. Essentially, this is just such a severe and significant deprivation of rights, and there's a potential for abuse. So this is just a very basic check and safeguard. Did I not say my name? I'm Kimberly McCullough from the ACLU of Oregon. I'm like looking at you guys with smiles. Thank you.
Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, Chair Przanski and members of the committee also in support of Senate Bill 502. I'll also be brief. I think the issues that I mentioned in the prior hearing, although we, you know, of course have great trust and confidence in the public guardian system, where it is the state that is intervening, the principles of liberty and protection and weighing that versus the necessity for intervention and deprivation, those are heightened concerns. So we appreciate the principle of reflected in the bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for the panel? Ladies, thank you very much. So that concludes our testimony on Senate Bill 502. We'll close that public hearing. We're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing for the day, which is Senate Bill 503. Jenna?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, you've heard a little bit today already about court visitors and their role in guardianship proceedings. Senate Bill 503 requires uniform court visitor policies be adopted statewide, and it includes a requirement that visitors hold professional licensure in good standing, such as physician, physician assistant, psychologist, therapist, or social worker, and to have 2 years of relevant experience in protective proceedings. Requires background checks, and it provides a process for appointment of a visitor to determine whether the protected person is no longer incapacitated and in need of a fiduciary, and to check on the suitability of the appointed fiduciary.
All right, thank you. So for the record, I'm going to go ahead and say that I've received a letter dated February 20th of this year from Stephen Heinrich, who's an attorney out of the Corvallis area. And that is not part of the record of mine looking at the oldest, so I will be submitting it to staff where we can get that as part of the public record. I would take away from the statements that he makes that he is opposed to the bill, and you can read his statements online if you didn't receive them individually. I'm not sure if he sent it to me in my capacity as a chair or if he sent it to all the committee members. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and start with those who are in favor, or at least have marked that they're in favor. Travis, why don't you go ahead and please come back up, and if I can go ahead and have Kimberly and Sybil come up, and then we'll take another group after that.
Chair, for a second, can you read us a name just so we have no note of what the report is?
Yeah, Stephen, being spelled S-T-E-V-E-N, Heinrich, I believe, H-E-I-N-R-I-C-H. Again, attorney at law, PhD, out of Corvallis.
Thank and, you.
All right. Travis, did you want to start on this?
Sure. Again, Travis Wall, the Oregon Public Guardian. Once more, thank you, Chairman, members. So let's talk about Senate Bill 503, and I'm going to expand to some degree on my written testimony. First, as you undoubtedly have been hearing from us today, there are a number of elements of due process that are very central to due process functioning as it needs to in these proceedings, protective proceedings. And a key element is the use of a court visitor. Again, as we've seen guardianship reforms take place over the past 30 years, a number of pieces have been advanced in most jurisdictions in most states, and one of those is the use of a court visitor, or in some cases it's referred to as a guardian ad litem, although sometimes guardian ad litem has an aside function in a different capacity. But the visitors and the guardian ad litems that function like visitors have a responsibility for independently evaluating the merits of a guardianship petition, determining whether the facts that are asserted by the petitioner have basis, and also evaluating the capacity or reviewing the information about the capacity of the person that the guardianship petition or conservatorship petition concerns. This is a very important role, particularly, again, in Oregon, where there is an absence of the other procedural elements that we've talked about, including the requirement for counsel and the requirement for hearing. Another piece that is lacking in Oregon that is really a part of almost every other set of guardianship statutes, when you look at states across the country, is a requirement that the petitioner come forward with evidence through an expert or a physician that attests to the person's incapacity. That's lacking here. Now, I think it's probably fair to say that there are many courts in which that is practically required, but there are other courts in the state where it is not. And in that environment, the role of the visitor becomes very important. Under current statute, the visitor, essentially, each circuit court or each district court is responsible for issuing an order that provides for the selection, the guidance, and the training of visitors. And in some of our larger counties, we can see that the courts have been very responsible and thoughtful about how they've set up these arrangements with the visitors. And in turn, we see well-qualified and experienced visitors who are capably carrying out their jobs in many circumstances. But unfortunately, that's not the case everywhere across the state. My program, although it's only 18 months old, has begun to file petitions, and we have done so in many different counties across the state, in addition to which we, through accident, have been involved with a case involving a professional fiduciary who was arrested and convicted of many crimes against her protected persons. And in reviewing her cases and in making certain that those individuals were cared for, we became familiar with what happened with many more guardianships across many different courts in Oregon. And my written testimony goes into detail about this. I won't restate the numbers in there, but you will see that in many circumstances we found that court visitor reports were lacking the information that needed to be there to demonstrate that there was a need for guardianship. In a number of instances, visitors did not actually interview the respondent, the alleged protected person, the the petitioning parties, and in many cases there was information. The information that would be there, need to be there to demonstrate the person lacked capacity was somewhat or altogether lacking. These are very troubling issues, and they speak to other problems with the way that our court visitor arrangements currently work, including the fact that in many jurisdictions across the state, the courts rely on a third party, usually the petitioner, to identify who will be used as the visitor. While some courts have lists, other courts don't. But even if they have lists, the petitioner is selecting it. The petitioner has an interest. And I say that as a petitioner. And I can tell you that in virtually every case in which we've been involved, we have been tasked by the court with selecting the visitor. I find myself very uncomfortable with that role. The court needs to be looking at what I'm doing. There needs to be an end party that that I don't pay, and I've paid for those court visitor reports that have been involved with the cases that we've done. So these are all the issues that SB 503 endeavors to deal with. Now, let me briefly share with you that there has been a fair amount of discussion that we've had in recent days about some elements of the bill with both some members of the Elder Bar as well as court visitors themselves. And I think there, you know, we need to talk more with Senator Dembrough as well as you about that. But there may need to be some further amendments to ensure that visitors that are presently qualified and doing a good job are grandfathered in. There's a question that's been raised about whether or not visitors should be required to have a license in some kind of healthcare-related field where somebody would have the opportunity to deliver, to develop the experience and the knowledge to carry out capacity decisions. The bill currently does specify that visitors would be limited to people who fall into one of those fields. People have pointed out that there are currently visitors that have substantial experience and a good body of knowledge that aren't licensed, and that there are also visitors who have licenses that may in fact not be qualified. So we may need to address some of these issues, but the point that the bill is trying to get at and the concern that we all have is that this visitor needs to function independently, needs to be qualified. There need to be uniform standards around the way that they are selected by the courts across the state, and there needs to be a rigorous training program so they in fact understand what it is that they need to do and have the knowledge and the requisite skills to do so. For all those reasons, we strongly recommend that this bill move forward.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also in support of Senate Bill 503. I defer to the expertise of the witness to my right and to others related to the mechanics of whether or not the way to assure standardization and high quality is through licensing or what the mechanism is. I don't have that expertise. What I can say from the Law Center's perspective in support of this bill is that the principle of making sure that a person who has the power and sort of is almost serving as a quasi-judicial role in advising the judge and the process around the appropriateness of either an initial guardianship or how a guardianship is working as it moves forward, it's really that's an incredibly important role, and we support the principle of that be an independent role and that the standards and training be consistent and high quality so that that perspective is reliable and in the best interests of the person to be protected. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm from the ACLU of Oregon. I will be brief again on this hearing and refer you back to my initial testimony with Senate Bill 501. And I also, like Sybil before me, defer to the expertise of folks who are more involved in this than I am. I just want to state for the record that from the ACLU of Oregon's perspective, just as an initial hearing and counsel are essential to the rights of individuals who are subject to guardianships, the having a court visitor essentially allows the court to, you know, the court needs to have oversight over these situations to prevent abuse, also to determine whether or not a guardianship it needs to continue because folks' circumstances can change. And a visitor essentially gives the court the ability to go out and look and see what's going on. And without that, the court is really, really blind to the circumstances of this person. So it's something that we support fully and wholeheartedly. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions for anyone on this panel?
Thank you all very much for coming forward. We have three other panels that we're going to hear from today. Second panel is Becky Strickland, Karen Spies, and Judge Welch, if you'll come back up on for the second panel. We'll have another panel that's kind of a yes and no and neutral, and then we'll have hear from some opponents. Oh, good morning. Whoever would like to go first?
Oh, okay. Senator Prozanski and committee, my name is Becky Strickland, and I'm the manager of the Adult Protective Service Unit in Lane County. And I'm here to talk about a couple situations that I experienced or a colleague of mine has experienced involving court visitors. It was until recently that I didn't realize that all court visitors were trained, educated, and in the same manner that our court visitors in Lane County are. I've been a manager for 17 years, and the quality of the court visitors' reports have been tremendous. Our particular judge provides education and training around the different kinds of abuse, how to interview and in an unbiased way and give good testimony and write a professional report. It was until recently that that I realized that was not consistently happening in the rest of Oregon. We had a person come to our office who was applying for guardianship but also wanted to register an abuse complaint about an intellectually developmentally disabled young man living in rural eastern Oregon. And they alleged that he was being locked in the closet, he was sleeping in a urine-soaked mattress, and that he was severely neglected and was living in a very rural part of our state. When the court visitor's report first came, this family brought it in for me to review, and it was atrocious. It was very, very poorly written. It had opinions and biases. It was clear to me that the court visitor had some relationship with a small community and had not interviewed all the important people that could make informed decisions on behalf of this young man. And so, because this family was fortunate enough to have an attorney represent them, the attorney asked the judge for another report. So a second report was written, and this family brought the second report in to me, which also did not adequately reflect the statements that they had made, left out quite a bit of important information to show the vulnerability of this individual and why this person needed a guardian. Again, the attorney requested from the judge the third time a third report. And this report, after review, resembled a somewhat professional and more unbiased report that I was accustomed to seeing. The second situation that I want to talk about is a colleague of mine I was speaking with from the Southern Oregon area, had a case involving an older adult whom was hospitalized after aspirating on food. When admitted to the hospital, they found a large dark purple bruise on their groin and stomach area, extending clear across the front of their body, side to side, from the belly button to the tailbone. During the APS investigation, the specialist had gone to the home and reported that the victim was living in a home where he was locked inside and barricaded. The windows were barricaded. There were some vehicles out front representing around $250,000, which the reported perpetrators, who were unemployed, owned. And they learned that this home, valued at $400,000, had been paid in full. The court visitors reported to the APS specialist in their report that the bruising on the reported victim was from hitting the couch with their thigh, and that the bruising traveling upwards, explaining the injuries on the abdomen. Later, a doctor confirmed that the bruising was from a direct blow, such as a kick or a punch, to the lower abdomen. The court visitor went on to say the bruising was from a Heimlich maneuver performed on the victim. He got all the information from the reported perpetrators. He said he wasn't accustomed to working or doing a visit and writing a report on a house that was not trashed and dirty and families that didn't appear to care. The court visitor had no reason not to believe the reported perpetrator's story. Even after the adult protective service worker met with the court visitor providing documentation explaining that the Heimlich maneuver isn't administered in the groin area and bruising doesn't travel upward against gravity, the court visitor still was not convinced. The court visitor had offered unreasonable excuses for the two reported perpetrators, and instead of being a neutral, objective third party, the court visitor sided with the reported perpetrators. This court visitor had no understanding of any of the types of abuse other than neglect. He or she was not concerned about the possible physical abuse and financial exploitation, or even that the vulnerable adult was being locked up. This court visitor had no education or training about the aging process, injuries, or the various kinds of abuses, or to assess limited or diminished capacity. Fortunately, the investigation continued and the evidence of the investigation outweighed the lackluster report, and guardianship and conservatorship was granted. In the end, the reported victim was removed to an appropriate care facility. It was discovered that along with the physical abuse, the victim was financially exploited of $600,000. The abuse resulted in multiple felony convictions for both of the reported perpetrators. Restitution of $370,000 was recovered. The reported victim also recovered additional properties in California, which prevented the victim from turning to Medicaid for care. The court visitor's response was simply, "They seem so nice, and I guess it was a good thing that APS followed up on the abuse." These are examples of why I support Senate Bill 503 and endorse the need for uniform policies, standards, protocols, procedures, and court visitor qualifications and training. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
The Supreme Court Task Force on Protective Proceedings, which worked in 07 and 08, it's been referred to earlier, that one of the recommendations was the creation of the Office of the Public Guardian.
Judge Welch, I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right.
Elizabeth Welch.
Thank you.
Another was all of the recommendations, basically, that are in this bill. There isn't a judge in this state that hears these kind of cases that doesn't rely heavily on court visitor, and I think you've heard enough from Ms. Strickland to understand why they are so important, and what's the matter when they're not qualified and when they don't know what they're doing. My experience is in several counties is that when a court visitor does a good, thorough job, the lawyers are able to resolve cases much more readily. In other words, the lawyers know the court visitor has clout with the judge and therefore is going to do what the judge says. As I mentioned earlier, the big issue in guardianship is this a proper guardian? And this is the way that gets ferreted out. It's all family dynamics. She is the petitioner. She's the eldest daughter of grandma. She is the original control freak, and she won't let anybody else have anything to do with mama unless they do what she wants. And she's just not appropriate. It's not in the best interest of this individual. That doesn't mean that she's stupid or evil like Becky's stories. It's just the dynamics of the situation. And if grandma's going to have the rest of her life peaceful and serene, she needs to have the right people making decisions for her. One of the things about qualifications is we've heard stories, and I don't know what jurisdiction or whether this still goes on, of attorneys who file petitions and use either their spouse or their legal assistant to be the court visitor. And I heard that from people, lawyers who were directly involved in cases where that happened. And it's understandable that there are problems in small towns. That's a reality. Is there anybody that fits all these qualifications that isn't already very busy doing another job or two? So it is challenging, but it is just the single most important, more important than any other thing we've talked about today, is this thorough investigation by knowledgeable, capable people. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you. And Karen, you're next?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, morning. Committee members. My name is Karen Spees. I live in Sherwood, Oregon. I'm here today to tell my father's story, Earl T. McLaughlin. He lives in McMinnville, Oregon, in a memory care unit. I urge you to move Senate Bill 503 forward because of what happened to my dad in 2015 when a Yamhill County court visitor deemed him incompetent. After my dad's wife, my stepmother, who raised me, filed a petition along with a guardian who has since been censured three times by the National Guardianship Association, filed to become my dad's guardian and conservator. I initially filed an objection to that petition because I did not believe that my father was incompetent. I only felt that since he had a stroke 2 years prior, that he only needed assistance in carrying out his affairs. I was very alarmed to find out that the petitioner, attorney, appointed the court visitor. I didn't know that until after the process, after I withdrew my objection, because the court visitor told me that I needed to withdraw my objection, that I did not want to expend thousands and thousands of dollars to fight this. That clearly was overstepping his boundaries as the court visitor. During the whole process, when he was interviewing me and other family members, I became very alarmed on how this court visitor conducted himself in the process. He spent the whole time telling me why my father was incompetent, but failed to ignore medical information that we had because we had supported our father during his period of time recovering from the stroke. And he refused to take medical information from a clinical psychologist who had deemed that my father had the early signs of dementia, but just needed to focus on living in a calm environment, avoid stress, and actually go to marital counseling because he was having a lot of problems with his wife. Instead, this court visitor proceeded to tell us throughout the entire process that we were wrong, that he was right, did not want to accept any information from us to show that our father was competent, but only as an 85-year-old man, just needed to have his family members to continue to support him in his twilight years. And that's why he had moved here in 2011, was to have his adult children help support him. After the court visitor rendered his recommendation to the court, he did a pretty good job focusing on the family dynamic and not on my dad's competency. And because of the aspects of having to go through a formal hearing and being told by this court visitor and my father's attorney, and I do want to back up on one important piece. When my father and my stepmother moved to Oregon in 2011, they had over $800,000. As a result of this entire process, my father now is on Medicaid. I strongly urge you to move 503 forward. What happened to my father in 2015 should not happen to any other Oregonian in this state. His rights and his dignity have been stripped. For nearly 2 years, his entire family was unable to see him. Through all of our efforts in the past 2 years, I am happy to report that I have finally seen my father, and we are moving closely with a new guardian and conservator to have unlimited access to our father. Because the new guardian, who, by the way, as I mentioned earlier, excuse me, I should say the old guardian, excuse me, the old guardian has been censured three times by the National Guardianship Association and to this day still serves as a professional fiduciary. Like what everyone has said here today, we need to do our best to protect the most vulnerable citizens in our society. And we have failed to do that, both through the court system and through the legislative process. The steps that you are looking to take now will help us to prevent these same abuses from occurring in the future. Thank you for your time.
Karen, thank you very much for coming forward and telling your story to us. Questions for the panel? Ladies, thank you very much. We have two other panels. I'm going to go ahead and take the panel that's here in objection so we can have that on the record. Just make sure we get everything in on time. So at this point, I'd ask that John Gere, Matt Whitman, and Heather Gilmore, if you three would please come forward. We have about 12 minutes to complete our testimony. I hope that you will be a little succinct. If you've already given testimony and since you've already handed stuff in that's part of our OLA system, please do not read it verbatim. If you'll just summarize for us those points, that would be great. And who would like to get started?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Matt Whitman. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland. I've been practicing for 18 years doing nothing, and for the last 12 years I've been doing nothing but probate litigation. I'm well familiar with the system of drafting attorneys that Judge Welch referred to. I have been drafted many times, sometimes by Judge Welch. And for the record, it's really important to understand that those of us who get drafted usually do so with the expectation that we are fulfilling an obligation to the court and to society and that we have no expectation of being paid. I have never been paid on a case where I have been appointed by the court. With respect to what's contemplated in this bill, I want to go ahead and point out the one place that I think we should all agree, which is that attorneys should have no role in selecting the visitor, period. But on the other hand, we also need to have two considerations here in this committee. Number one, there is the principle of legislative minimalism. We should not be legislating where there already is existing law. And with respect to the vast bulk of this bill, that is true. So for example, ORS 125-160, as it is written, already gives courts enormous flexibility in when to appoint visitors after the initial threshold point. A court can appoint a visitor at any point right now. And that means that we don't need the amendments to ORS 125-150 1B that are in the bill, nor the additions to 125-160. Number two, a couple of times, Chair Przanski, you've referred to the idea that this bill, if it's passed out, will eventually go to Ways and Means, and I'll give you my layperson's interpretation of that, and they will figure out whether or not we can actually pay for it. And that's true, of course, but that's also not a reason not to have the discussion about whether or not this bill is grounded in the real world. I have litigated protective proceedings all over the state. And I will tell you that this bill would essentially not change the standard of practice in Multnomah County, in Clackamas County, in Lane County. But the problem is that this is a simple supply and demand problem with respect to qualified visitors. There are many places in this state where there are no people currently serving as court visitors who would meet the standards set out in this bill. ORS 125-165 already requires presiding judges of every single county to promulgate standards like the standards that Judge Waller has promulgated. She has a standing order. It's dated May 18th, 2015, that lays out standards that may be more exacting than ones in this bill. And that, therefore, it would not change things in Multnomah County. But there is no one doing court visitor reports in Curry County. None. In Coos County, there may be one person or there may be zero, but imposing more restrictions on who can do a report is not going to do anything to operate on the supply and demand curve that gives us more qualified visitors doing the thorough, neutral, educated reports that everyone in this room will agree are necessary. And that takes me to the second main point of my testimony, which is why it's not appropriate to just say, well, ways and means will figure out whether it can be paid for. Because when we talk about appointing counsel for protected people, it's easy to say, well, ways and means can figure out whether or not we can somehow fund lawyers for these people. But with respect to court visitors, it's not the state that pays for it, at least as a threshold matter. It's the petitioner. And so if you have a situation, as you do in Multnomah County, where the petitioner has to first front the filing fee, which is not that much, but then has to pay $550 as a court visitor fee, well, that is a significant additional entry cost. And if someone can't come up with that, can't pay for the visitor, then in fact, you are not going to have a protective proceeding. And if you aren't going to have a protective proceeding, for reasons of cost, for someone who otherwise needs protection, well, what you've done is you've essentially decreased the protections available to vulnerable people. And that is what Judge Welch, in her 2008 report that we've heard about, she referred to this in the report, where she talked about states being forced to undertake reform with insufficient time and resources in response to social and political pressure resulting from publicity surrounding isolated but extreme abuses. And with respect, I think that what Ms. Strickland and Ms. Spees talked about in the past 10 minutes were exactly those isolated but extreme abuses. But Judge Welch also wrote that we need to have proactive, strategic, and reform needs to be proactive, strategic, and comprehensive to minimize unintended negative consequences. And that's what this bill represents. I would respectfully suggest that if this bill is going to move forward, then there are two constituencies that have to be brought into this process. I'm not saying the bill should move forward, but the two constituencies are the elder law section of the bar, who represent the people with boots on the ground who know about when the court visitor system works and when it doesn't. And number two, the presiding judges of the counties who are already supposed to be doing what this bill would impose from the top down. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Matt. So who'd like to go next? And I'm just gonna give a time check. We have about 5 or 6 minutes. So I wanna, if you don't have enough time today, we can reschedule for you to come back. I know both of you are from Marion County. So who'd like to go next?
I'm Heather Gilmore. I'm an attorney in private practice in Marion County. Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair, I've been an attorney for more than 25 years. I've been actively involved in protective proceedings for all of that time period. I have experience representing respondents. I've been drafted innumerable times by the court, by Adult Protective Services through DHS, by the ARC of Oregon, and by other agencies that look after the needs and concerns of the elderly, disabled, intellectually impaired, mentally ill persons. So I've been on both sides. I've been a regular volunteer for Legal Aid. I've volunteered my time for Disability Rights Oregon. I've also been the attorney for a professional fiduciary before we had the public guardian's office, and I've been the attorney for numerous private parties petitioning the court for protective proceedings. So I have a balanced perspective about what happens in these. I've been involved in abuse cases where the state police with SWAT teams have had to take disabled persons out of homes. I've been involved in Tillamook County where we had no visitor except for a social worker at the DHS office. I'm concerned about the impact of this bill on outlying counties. I've provided a substantial summary of the bill from a practical boots-on-the-ground perspective. It characterizes exactly what the bill does and doesn't do. It identifies what the statute already allows and what the statute does change and does not change. I've also given you a background regarding the law and the practice so you can have some practical idea of what really happens out there. I agree that there are numerous problems with the current visitor system. There are so many differences from county to county, it's difficult for lawyers in private practice to figure out what the rules are. We have attempted previously to standardize the practice. This has not gone without activity by the elder law section and the estate planning section of the bar. For example, we have both mandated presiding judge orders that require qualifications and experience, and we have a uniform trial court rule that standardizes the form of the report. The resources in the metropolitan counties are greater than the resources in rural counties. I practice it primarily in Marion, Polk, Yamhill, and occasionally Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, and the outlying counties. Our resources in Marion County look very different than Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, and Lane. We have made an intentional effort to improve our visitor process in our county, and we have a difficult time doing that with both the court, qualified lawyers, other professionals attempting to recruit people for this position. In Marion County in 2008, we had the Visitor Improvement Project. I was the chair of that project. I worked with the judges, the visitors, the attorneys, and social services coming up with a plan for Marion County. I've provided you with what we came up with in my materials. At the time that we worked on that plan, we went to our court system, our trial court administrator, and said, we would like some help from the court. We would like the court to provide us with services to collect the visitor's fee. The court said, we appreciate your problem very much. We do not have the staffing to do that, nor do we have an accounting system to do that. We said, Multnomah County does it. Why can't we? Their response was, Multnomah County has greater resources than Marion County. We asked the court then if they would provide us with assistance for distributing the training manual and the training CDs that we made on our own dollars. The court again said, we do not have the staffing or the resources to assist you. Finally, because of our concern about the manner in which visitors can be appointed, we asked the court to delegate the responsibility for locating visitors to court staff. Again, we were met with the response that the court does not have the manpower to accomplish this. In the metropolitan counties, it's easy for court staff to identify the visitor. There's a limited number of them. They're very professional. They have enough work to do that they can do it essentially as a job. In Marion and other counties, it's kind of a job that you have on the side that you may or may not have time to take a particular case on that day. We have very short time frames in guardianship and conservatorship proceedings. 15 days from the date of appointment, the visitor has to submit their report. In temporary proceedings, 3 days from the date of appointment, the visitor has to interview the respondent, and 5 days within the date of the appointment, they have to submit the report. As a practical matter, that's going to be a challenge in rural counties to have people with these qualifications meeting those statutory deadlines.
All right. Heather, I'm going to ask you to summarize the end because I want to try to get John in.
Great.
And then for committee members, I know we're getting on that bewitching hour, so if you need to leave, I want to finish this. And then I have a couple other people who've given testimony on the other bills, Gail and Angela, and it looks like Samantha Benton's here is in a neutral position for the Department of Justice. Our judicial department, excuse me. And so I know we can get her to come back if we want to. I'll let you know the bill's not moving today. It's going to have some more work done on it. Based on what the chair's heard, we're not ready to, even if we had everything ready. So if you, and then the other thing I want to say for those, if you don't have time to stay here, you can give us written testimony. The record's still open. And we can take that testimony that way as well. Heather?
So I just want to summarize the last three pages of my testimony talk about alternatives and potential improvements to Senate Bill 503. Those include currently implementing the law that we have on the books, which is not done, modifying the qualifications to allow retired professionals and non-practicing professionals to serve as visitors, and expanding the type of qualifications authorized for visitors to serve. I also think that the local courts should have clear discretion to decide who their visitors can be. If the court doesn't have confidence and trust in the visitor, doesn't matter what their training is, what their credentials are, the court has to trust those people. Finally, I have some technical provisions that I think we need to clarify, some ambiguous language to properly implement the proposed bill. And last, my closing comment is I think that the committee should amend the bill to allow the court to permissively appoint visitors for conservatorships for minor children. The things that we've been talking about today really don't apply to minor children where there's a conservatorship, and this is explained to you why it doesn't work in those circumstances in my testimony. Thank you.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Gere. I'm a local attorney in private practice. I practice a focus in elder law. I'm a member of the elder law section. I'm here speaking only for myself because of my concern about this bill. In addition to doing work as in guardianships and conservatorships, I have originated a course on end-of-life planning that I have given several times with my wife. My wife is a master's-prepared social worker who ran the survey program for nursing homes and elder care facilities in Michigan, came to Oregon, and was the head of licensing and quality of care.
I appreciate the comments as to what your wife has done, but I really need you to focus. I've got members that need to leave as to your comments on 503.
Understood. I just want to point out that the qualifications you have would rule out someone with 20 years of elder law of elder care experience who has a master's in social work and significant elder care experience because of your choice. The credentialing requirements, I want to support what she said. The presiding judges are responsible for choosing visitors, or should be responsible for choosing visitors, and these credential-based requirements that award qualifications based solely on credentials, terrible idea. Essentially, this is, I believe, very well-intended idea to address a very real problem. But I think the counter effects, the unintended side effects, overwhelm the positive effects of this bill. I would suggest instead that we make APS offices across the state the source for visitors, and we solve the problem with a public option or a single payer approach, which is you can get your visitors from the government. They are trained to investigate. They are trained to understand the family dynamics. They are neutral. They have no dog in the fight. They're not picked. And I also think that if you want to increase abuse of vulnerable people, require visitors be appointed for all conservatorships, because you will have a lot fewer conservatorships, and the people will have no court involvement and no, they will not come to the attention of the court at all. And I could go on, but I know time is short. I oppose this bill. I think it needs a serious rethink to create a performance-based system that actually monitors what visitors do. And when these incidents, these horror stories come up, there needs to be a root cause analysis for what went wrong, rather than simply saying that you could, you can on the front end raise the qualifications for visitors and then you don't have to worry. That's not the case at all. Thank you. All right.
Thank you very much. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and excuse the members for their other tasks that they have coming up at 10. What I will do is for the three that are still here, Gail, Angela, and Samantha, if you want to make some type of statements, if you think you need to make statements based on what you've heard, I will stay here and just take those as part of the record. The other thing that can happen, though, is that you can put it in writing. I will tell you that this bill is going to have to come back before us, so you can have another time to testify once you see what product comes out of any additional work. Without any additional work, I'll commit to everyone that's on this. The bill's not moving as is. There's going to have to be some changes. So with that, I think I'm going to not take your testimony because I know members like to be here and such. And so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 503 at this point, understanding that there'll be some work. I'll have a small work group work through Channel Newell. And I'll have Senator Denborough being part of that effort as well. With that, we're going to close for today. We're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8. And colleagues, thank you very much. Thank you very much.